Hello and welcome to the Chengdu Gaming Federation podcast. My name is Charlie and I'm joined by a guest named Ryan. Say what's up, introduce yourself.
Hello, this is Ryan.
All right. Today we are going to be talking about the Chinese gaming industry. This is a topic that I've had on my mind to record in a podcast for a long time. And this is a very China-centric topic, one which I have a lot of experience with and one which my guest has experience with as well. China is a, how shall I say, notorious place to work in the game industry. How would you describe it in a word to someone who would be listening?
It's kind of like working in a circus.
Yeah, it's a little circus-like. It's kind of defined by its craziness, the size and scale of everything. The gaming industry in China is so large, and it's kind of like undeveloped at the same time that it's a lot of infrastructure. There's a lot of companies, there's a lot of money, there's a lot of games, but there's also a definite feeling of lack of development, kind of cultural development.
Yeah, which is strange because you just told me that China was declared the number one gaming capital of the world today.
Yeah, by Bloomberg. Right. It's the biggest gaming market in the world. Actually, so it's the headline is China just became the games industry capital of the world. This was published June 1st, 2017, just over a month ago by Bloomberg. And it's about global revenue passing $100 billion for the first time, fueled by smartphone use. And the largest country of revenue is China. And the United States is number two, and I think Japan is number three. But this is interesting because just a few years ago, when I was following this information a lot more closely than I am now, the United States was number one, and I think Japan was number two, and China was number three. And at the time, there was a lot of forecasting about how big China would become and how China would be number one. And there's a lot of, you know, bluster around this, you know, Chinese people, we're number one, like this kind of stuff. And now it's actually happened, which is a little surprising. But when you look at the numbers, it's not that shocking. I mean, the number of people.
It's just a numbers game.
Right. So tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you come to China? And more importantly, how did you end up working in games?
Well, that's a long story. I came to China after having started an IT company. And I did a little work here and there, just trying to get a visa and learn Chinese. But after I learned some Chinese, I thought it would be cool to go work in the mobile gaming industry because Chengdu is where we are, is the capital of mobile games in China. So I started off with a photography app called Fotor.
Yeah.
Fotor. And there's a couple of foreigners on that team. And I was in their marketing department and I did a lot of stuff like producing videos that marketed their app. And then from there, I went on to a Chengdu gaming company and then a Chengdu game publishing company that would take Chinese games and try to publish them in the West. So I worked for a couple of different Chinese mobile game companies.
That sounds pretty similar to me. So I started working with a mobile app developer before that company became a game developer. So I was kind of looking for jobs. This is in 2010, and I found this mobile app developer, and they were looking for a user interface designer. And I met them, and they were really nice people. And they were really enthusiastic, and they were like, oh, great. Like, you can design like the user interface for this app that we're building. I'm like, well, I've never done UI design before, ever. And they're like, well, what have you done? And I showed them what I had done. And they're like, oh, you'll be able to figure it out. No problem. And it's a real like China story. I think China is like a great place for those kind of opportunities. And so I thought, you know, hey, if you're going to trust me, then like, all right, I'll give it a shot. And it ended up working out. And then about a year after that, the company decided to pivot and to develop games.
Oh, okay.
And I think that there are a lot of people like us in China, people who are working in the game industry in China who don't have any prior experience working in the game industry, but just kind of end up getting swept up into it because it's so large.
Right.
And I, in my time working in my previous employer, I hired a number of friends, like almost 10, I think, to work with me.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah. It was a good time. I mean, it was a, you know, ups and downs, but basically the company was growing so quickly. And this is, you know, happening in a lot of Chinese companies, although I think lesser now than it was maybe 4 years ago. I feel like we might have passed the fastest time of growth. But
Sure. And I think my story is the same as yours. A couple of friends were working at this Fotor and they brought me on board. And at first it all seemed really great. We were really excited to help this company and we thought we could make a difference. And then after a while, everyone just kind of disappeared. I think that's what happened with your friends.
Well, what happened? So basically it's also a long story, but I'll make it short. So essentially when I joined the company, it was 8 people and it was a very small development team. Everybody knew everybody. And there was a great degree of everybody's working together to achieve something really cool. And so everybody's heart was kind of into it and it was a really enjoyable, great time. The company was really small, so it wasn't really making much money. And, you know, no one there was rich, but it all had a feeling like it mattered and it meant something. And as the company started to find success, I remember we made our first game. We spent 3 months making a game. And as soon as we released it, it found 10,000 users within the first week.
Wow.
Which was really, really exciting. This was in 2011. So at that time, you know, the mobile gaming industry was not really developed and there wasn't much competition and it's nothing like now. You worked in publishing, so you certainly know what's involved with marketing a game and promoting a game and how much it takes and how much competition there is and how difficult it is. So it was nothing like that at the time, but it was really exciting to feel, you know, making progress. And as the company started to grow, you know, my responsibilities and position in the company became more and more, and people were looking at me to bring more people on board, especially people who had, you know, international experience and people who spoke Chinese and knew what the world outside of China was like. And I thought I had a lot of friends that would really enjoy it and the company would value them. And they did for a long time and it went really well for a period. But eventually the company grew to a size where it all became pretty heartless. And it kind of turned a little bit into like sweatshop environment where the leadership and management of the company would, you know, basically force people to work overtime every day. And people in the company started to feel like it didn't matter. Like the results of what they were doing were disconnected from, you know, them personally. So whether the game, you know, succeeds or fails, doesn't really matter. I don't really care. I just have to sit in this seat for X number of hours a day. And it started to kind of just get worse and worse from there. And eventually, you know, all the people that I brought on just said, hey, you know, I'm going to go do something else. And in some cases, they, you know, I was managing them and they came to me and they were like, well, these conditions are really not good. And I would say, yeah, well, I'm doing everything I can to, you know, help you out and fight for you. But there's only so much I can do because this is a Chinese company and this is China and I'm not Chinese. And so in some cases, I told them, you know, hey, I think you're best off just going to do something else because this is no longer a circumstance where I can control these conditions.
Yeah, there's something called, I don't know if it's like a gaming industry thing or just a work thing here in China. It's called the 996. Are you familiar with this?
Absolutely, yes.
And it's the China version of the 9-to-5. And it means you work 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. And that's considered the norm. If your boss makes you work, that they don't have to pay you overtime.
Right. And it's just kind of accepted as in, you know, I found a lot of Chinese colleagues. As my previous employer was implementing a system like that, there was just an uproar, especially among the people that I worked with. So all the foreigners that I worked with were, of course, like, this is ridiculous. There's no way we're going to do this. Like, we are not cool working 20 hours of overtime, which is unpaid per week.
Right.
We're just not going to do it. And the Chinese colleagues in the company were kind of like, oh, this sucks, but, you know, this is how China is and we have no options and there's nothing we can do. So there was definitely a feeling of helplessness to it, which kind of contributed to that sweatshop feeling. And I think implementing those types of rules in the company were like a really big turning point, which kind of killed the culture of the company, in my opinion.
Yeah, I know. I tried to fight that. I tried to not work the 9-9. I definitely didn't do the 6. But as one of the few foreigners in my company, the only person who was leaving at 5, it kind of made me feel like a jerk when all of my Chinese colleagues were then staying till 9 p.m.
Totally. Yeah, I can really understand that. What I found, what we did was, you know, once we discovered that the company was just focused on, you know, meeting this meaningless metric of having, you know, X number of hours worked per week, well, we thought, all right, well, most of the people in the company are not really using their time efficiently, because what the company communicates by implementing such a system is that what's important is not what you do, but how many hours you spend inside the office. And so we found that a lot of people in the company responded just by wasting time inside the office. They would come inside the office and they would just play games or screw around or work on their own personal projects or do whatever they wanted to do. And eventually we kind of started to do that too. We got a PlayStation 4 in our office, like in the room that we worked in. We just spent a bunch of time playing that. And just in general, we were kind of like, hey, you know, there's not a lot of pressure on us to be efficient all day, but there is a lot of pressure on us to spend a lot of hours in the office.
Yeah, I had a similar situation and I just worked on my own stuff and nobody seemed to care.
Right. This is so far we're painting a pretty bleak picture of China's game industry. Tell me a little bit about some of the games that you worked on.
Yeah, so the first game company I worked for,
I actually thought that they had some pretty cool games, relatively speaking, with what's coming out in China. They had some tower defense games. When I started, they had an RPG that was, it was funny because it was like, it was just a hodgepodge of Western stuff. It was like King Arthur fights the Yeti, fights the Abominable Snowman, fights Zeus. And they just, you could tell they just took things that were Western and just put them together in this game. So I tried to work with them a little bit on that and make the game make sense from a Western perspective. And I found that the more games that they came out with, it was always the same thing where they're trying to make it culturally relevant to Westerners, but they just don't understand. And for some reason, they don't want to ask for help. They'll go in a back room and then they'll come out a week later with this really weird hodgepodge of ideas and they'll say, all right, fix the English in this.
Yeah, and it's like it needs a lot more than just correcting the English. I found that also. I found that even just English alone. So a lot of foreigners who work in Chinese gaming companies are working with translation or with generally just communicating, you know, what Chinese developers are trying to get across to non-Chinese audience. And what I found in a lot of cases is that my previous employer especially would promote things which had just outright incorrect English on it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, hey, there's a whole department of foreigners. You could have taken just 5 minutes to ask us. And they're like, oh, well, you know, I thought it was like good enough. And this kind of attitude of good enough, which in Chinese is chabuduo, which means like, ah, oh, it's good enough. This attitude just pervades everything in China. And this is what makes it so rare that you see a Chinese product which is really well made or can actually compete with an international product, because there is this culture of just saying, ah, this will do good enough.
Right. And I think for whatever reason, there's something embedded in the culture where they do not want to ask for help from outsiders. I think that's a big thing here.
Interesting. So tell me a little bit more about the games. What kind of games were they? Were they specifically targeting foreign markets, or were these games in China as well?
Yeah. So I guess back then, foreign markets were the target because Chinese players were considered not very valuable because they weren't willing to spend money in the game. I think that's changing more now and the Chinese player is worth more.
Yeah.
But we would typically try to target North America, Europe, Australia. Those are the most valuable markets. And most of the games were based on finding a game that looked successful and copying the shit out of it.
Yeah.
And maybe making some minor changes, like to the name. There's a lot of really funny copy-ish names out there. One of my favorites, you told me you saw at a gaming convention, was Clash of Thrones.
Right, Clash of Thrones. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so you get a lot of stuff like that. I don't want to name any of the specific games we're working on, but generally there are copies of other games with small changes.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the ones which I worked on also, like pretty much without exception, are copying or heavily borrowing from something which is extremely well known. And that seems to be kind of the template in China. But tell me a little bit about some of the games which were the models. So, I mean, for the gaming companies which you worked in, usually it's these massive products like Clash of Clans, which is made by Supercell, which is copied by 10,000 Chinese developers. Mm. Was it Clash of Clans, or was there another well-known game which was kind of the model that was the source of inspiration?
You know, there's one that really, it comes to mind when you say that, because there was a game, it was made by a Western developer,
And it was the same exact game as Clash Royale, but before Clash Royale. And we started copying it. And we added we changed the art style. It looked pretty cool. It looked really promising.
I think I remember that. I think I remember you showing me that.
And I think if we had just been on the ball and released this game before Clash Royale, we could have been millionaires because it was a really cool game. But they ended up releasing it 6 months after Clash Royale came out, and obviously nobody wanted to play it.
Yes. I remember actually when Supercell unveiled Clash Royale was 4 months before the game came out. And as soon as they unveiled that, immediately there were Chinese developers who were reverse engineering it right off the bat.
Yeah,
and
like the next week.
Yeah, like the next week immediately. They're like, oh, we need to get this out before Clash Royale comes out. And that is kind of in a nutshell, just sort of how China works. And a lot of these developers tend to take this approach where I know that one of the developers I think you worked for did this, where they just throw everything at the wall and they're like, something's got to stick, you know, with dozens of products.
Yeah, right. That's pretty common.
Yes. So after you spent some time in game companies, tell me about, you're no longer working in the game industry now, right?
So I went from, first I went from a game developer to a game publisher. And I feel like working for a game publisher, that's where I really got to see the dirty side of Chinese gaming.
Oh, describe that, please, because I've never really worked in a publisher.
Yeah. So, and I don't know if this is just China or if this is all game publishers, but I felt like this was especially Chinese, is that the there was no consideration at all for the game, whether the game was fun or whether players would like the game. It was entirely a business model for them, which sounds reasonable if you're running a business, except that the games these guys were picking up were the worst games I've ever played in my life. If you sat down and tried to make a torture game that made people not want to play it, that's what these games were. And I could not understand why we were publishing these games. And I don't understand why anyone would play them. They were...
Man, I also had experiences like that. So what I experienced in particular, one of the big models which I found was being copied by everyone was Game of War, which was made by Machine Zone, right? Mm-hmm. And this was one of the top grossing games in the world. It still is probably top three. And it was developed by Machine Zone. It's an SLG game, which is a base building, troop building war game. And I just couldn't stand this game. I just didn't like it at all. The game made tons and tons of money. And I had so many discussions with my colleagues where, we're kind of forced to deeply understand everything that this game is doing. Why do so many people play it? Why do so many people spend so much money and time in this game? What is it that this game is doing right? And, my first impression of the game was, this game sucks. I just hate this game. It forces you to buy things all the time. It's pay to win. It's just complete garbage. It looks terrible. It's not fun to play. It is just a game which I really hate,
There's no strategy at all. It's called a strategy game, but it's just a game about playing.
Just spend all day. Yeah, play and pay and you'll win. Exactly. There's really not any strategy. And I did have some colleagues who were kind of there, just doing a job and they don't really care about games, right? And
yeah, probably that's very common.
Yeah. So, for me, and I know for you too, because you're an independent developer and you're, active in the culture of games as I am. For people who really like games, it's not easy to work on those things, because for me, I'm kind of having this internal struggle where I'm I'm really not doing good things with some of these products. This is kind of just perpetuating a bad cycle. And I also went to GDC every year for 5 years. And I mean, in some cases, I felt a little bit not a great person. I'm kind of just helping this Chinese company. And especially because at GDC, I heard from so many people who were working on such inspiring, positive projects. And it's just man, I'm just trying to do my best to guide this Chinese developer in the right direction. But it's a real uphill struggle.
Yeah, as I got deeper into publishing and to what makes a monetization of a game successful, I really realized that the strategies that they use to make a game successful monetarily are the same psychological strategies that they use in slot machines.
Exactly.
And gambling addiction.
Yeah, Machine Zone, the company name is a reference to slot machines.
Right. Okay. So you'll see a lot of the same exact stuff that it just triggers something in the human brain that makes you addicted. You have random rewards.
It's a Skinner box.
Yeah, Skinner box. Yeah. There's a list of just things that make people addicted, even if the game's not fun. You could probably help me with this list. There's random rewards.
Yeah.
What else is there?
Loot boxes, instant feedback, flashy prizes, you know, gift boxes, which are falling out of the screen and opening up, dramatic reward systems. Daily rewards, that's a big thing. Keep people coming back all the time.
Abstracted currency, like when you go into the casino, they give you chips instead of money, so you lose track of what you're spending.
Right, yeah, absolutely. And just in general, the free-to-play retention mechanic, mm-hmm. you know, with previous games, you know, with games in general, the metric is sales. You know, mm-hmm. how many copies did Grand Theft Auto 5 or The Witcher 3 or Broforce sell? And that mm-hmm. is the metric. That's the yardstick by which they measure the success of a game. But in mobile games, obviously revenue is like the big one. But one of the other big ones, which in many cases is emphasized or prioritized over revenue, is retention. Is mm-hmm. how much time are people spending in the game? And at what rate are they coming back into the game? How many times a day do they open the app? And the things you do to get retention are in many cases like pretty scumbaggy things.
Yeah, one of the things is offer something very cheap in the beginning, because when the player makes the first purchase, they now feel invested in the game. And as they feel more and more invested making purchases, it'll be much harder for them to quit this game that they've put all this money into. And that's when you start hitting them with $50, $100 in-app purchases, and they'll pay them to win.
Yeah, get your hooks in. Going back to a point which you made earlier about, you know, I can't believe that people play this, people spend money on this. Some of the games which I worked on, I mean, one of the games which I made the concept for became one of the biggest games in my previous employer's portfolio. And over like a 1 year long development cycle, the game looked like something totally different at the end. And it worked. I mean, it made a lot of money. A lot of people played it. Like, millions of people downloaded the game. But by that point, I was kind of shocked because I was playing the game and I was like, man, I can't believe how much people are into this. I mean, if you go to the top grossing ranks on the iPhone App Store and play some of those games, I mean, it's a little shocking because the App Store is so filled with tremendously well-designed games. I mean, there are like countless really, really well-designed, fantastic games. And you will not see those anywhere near the top grossing list generally.
Right.
And obviously China is the same way. So, I mean, if you look at the top grossing apps in China, they are, I mean, almost without exception, games that probably nobody listening to this podcast would have any interest in. I'm going to guess. There are some exceptions. Overwatch is popular in China. And I'm trying to think of other ones. League of Legends, but I mean, very few. I mean, you can count them on one hand pretty much.
Yeah, another thing people don't, players don't consider, especially with mobile games, is how big advertising is a part of the business model, and how for a mobile game developer, they're looking at purchasing you as a customer to bring you in to see if they can make money off of you. And with advertising, these companies are doing really funny stuff. Like, they just don't care what they'll do to bring you in. There's a pretty big game publisher here that literally takes screenshots of other games that are fun and then advertises them as their game.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that a lot.
And I believe they're the number one mobile game on Facebook. Is that right?
Oh, yes. I know. Yes, that's right. That's right. That was Clash of Kings.
Right.
So Clash of Kings, and this was a very big, very successful developer. They've made a ton of money. And yeah, that was Facebook Game of the Year. I mean, can you believe that? They took screenshots of games which are not even mobile games.
Like Civilization.
Like, yeah, and Call of Age Duty, of Civilization 5, exactly. And they would feature those screenshots in their advertisements. And I remember actually discussing that with colleagues and saying, look at this. Isn't this deplorable? This is like such bad behavior. This is so completely wrong. And in a lot of cases, the response was like, do you see how much money the game is making? So I found, like, in general, there's like really kind of a total lack of principles, you know, like the idea that you do anything to make money. Anything is worth it if you make money, because it's only about the end game. One of the big metrics which I have always heard discussed was LTV. Did you ever follow that closely?
The lifetime value of a player.
Exactly. Yes.
So Tell us about it.
LTV was like the holy grail metric for many years. And I would hear it mentioned all the time. There would constantly be research and studies and articles and discussion and debate over LTV, how to raise the LTV, how to get the LTV to a certain amount. And managers in the company would just go on and on about how that was the most important metric and that was what everyone must focus on. The idea is that each player who comes into a game has one number which you can give them as far as the value which they bring to the company. So whether they spend one day or one year inside the app, you can find an average for how much money the average person spends inside of the game. And once you determine what that is, then you can figure out how much money you can spend to get one user. So if you get the LTV up to, say, $20, then you can pay $10 to get users if you can do that. And you can do that all day long and just print money. And a lot of developers did this for a very long time. But what kind of disrupted this cycle is that the user acquisition costs went through the roof as people started to figure out that you could just buy users at a lower rate than, you know, they were producing revenue. And the amount to acquire a user basically has like gone up by a factor of 20 in the last 5 years.
Yeah, I know now in publishing, it's not so much about getting users because not all users are created equal. It's about getting the whales, the players that are going to spend thousands of dollars in the game. And the companies that are successful, I know your company was pretty good at this. That information on how to target these whales and bring them into their game is highly proprietary. And it's very much tied into Facebook advertising. Maybe if one game goes down, all the whales are going to leave and then you want to catch them and bring them into the new game.
Right.
So it's very much, it's about whales in this industry. And I always really wonder, who are these whales?
Man, I would love to know. I'll tell you what though, like I did have a time where a portion of my work was in actually corresponding with users inside of our games.
Okay.
And communicating with them on a regular basis. And in some cases, we actually also started kind of a moderator system. And that was where we had volunteer players who would help to moderate like public chat inside the game. So chat started with the first game that we developed. Public chat was like kind of, I think we were like one of the first games which like offered that. First like SLG kind of MMO games where people could come in and just chat. And we found something really interesting. What we found was that a lot of people would come in and they would just chat all day long and they wouldn't even really play the game. They didn't have interest in playing the game. They just wanted to interact with other people. And that developed into people cursing each other, people posting swastikas, I mean, all kinds of
general internet stuff.
Yeah, general internet stuff. And so we found a need to find people to kind of tame the chat room. And so we created this moderator system and got in touch with players who were really committed and devoted to the game and were willing to volunteer their time to help us clean it up. And through this process, the moderator system expanded and got to eventually over 300 moderators around the world. And the you know, managers of all the moderators who were themselves volunteers who were spending an incredible amount of time in the game just managing this. I mean, they had Google documents where they would manage, you know, where the moderators were and what hours they were on and which servers they were on. I mean, it was like a real job. Mm. And I got to know some of these people through this. And in some cases, those were whales. You know, those were players themselves who would spend a lot of money. And in other cases, there were players who would spend... I remember the first time that I discovered that, you know, people in these types of games can spend over $1 million, like one player.
And I'm always thinking, is this like a Saudi prince who just has nothing to do all day? Or is this some sad basement dweller who's using his like inheritance money?
That's a great question, man. I would love to like interview someone like that and be like, what else do you spend your money on? You know, because like... I mean, if you just do the math, you know, the largest in-app purchase at the time was $99. And if you spend, you know, $50,000 a month, which certainly people did, and people definitely do that right now, like in not insignificant numbers, how many purchases is that? How many times are you hitting the buy button just to make that happen? I mean, it's a huge number of times. Like, it's incredible that people actually spend that amount of time on an iPhone game. But you would be surprised. This is a $100 billion industry. That is a lot of money.
Yeah, I know when I visited our Korean branch, they were sharing with us that the Korean government introduced regulations where you have to cap the in-app purchases by players.
Really?
So on a monthly basis, any game can only take in so much money from a given player because people were doing this. And so these games, now they're trying to work around that. The first of every month, they have a big sale. And it's all about trying to get up that revenue before they spend it in other games.
Wow. That's incredible. I hadn't heard of that. Interesting stat, which I read recently, App Annie is probably a tool which you use all the time as well, right?
Right.
So it's like the industry standard for the mobile gaming industry tool to do investigation and discovery of which apps are making money and how they're making it and in which countries. App Annie stated that as much as 93% of all money spent by Chinese gamers go to titles developed by Chinese-based companies. Hmm. So what we find in China is that the Chinese domestic market, as large as it is pretty much not viable for foreign companies. So a lot of foreign companies look at the size of the Chinese gaming market, which is 600 million people spending $24.6 billion. And they think, you know, hey, that's a great opportunity. That's a great market to be in. But for the vast majority of non-Chinese companies, which are in the Chinese market, they're not successful. And the ones which are successful are generally in partnership arrangements with Tencent or NetEase or a major Chinese publisher who is publishing their games.
Yeah, it's basically impossible to enter the Chinese market without a local partner. There's a number of reasons. The Google Play Store is incredibly fragmented because it's blocked here. So there's like hundreds of little Google Play Stores.
Android, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah. Another one is government regulations that just literally make it illegal for a foreign company to just publish a game. You have to send in an iPhone
with the app installed, and it's like a 3-month review process.
Go through a review. There's a number of things.
And actually, the law states now the app cannot have any English anywhere in it. It cannot have anything which it cannot have violence in it. There's like a long list of things which it cannot include.
I know when that law came out, I was at a gaming company and they were so frustrated because in their game, they had victory and defeat as pictures.
Yeah.
And now they had to go through and redraw all these pictures and write as Chinese characters because you couldn't have English victory and defeat. Or
you know,
anything.
Games were even rejected because they wrote HP. Because that violates the no English rule. I mean, literally right. Cannot have any foreign influence at all because China is just terrified of foreign influence taking power in China. Obviously, this is not just restricted to games. This is why television shows are banned in China. Most movies, 95% of Western movies will never get released in China. And all media and culture in general is tightly controlled by the Communist Party, which governs China. And we certainly see that in the game industry.
You know, I feel like we've been saying a lot of truth here. I feel like we should maybe end on a happy note.
Yeah, I think so too. I was thinking about that.
Let's. How about we share our favorite things about the Chinese gaming industry?
You know, I think there's a lot of positive things to say. I think that when people like you and I sit down and talk about the Chinese gaming industry, it tends to be like war stories of like, oh, I've seen so many crazy things. Like, oh, I've seen crazier than that, you know, because you do come face to face with a whole lot of ridiculous things when you're a Westerner working in the Chinese gaming industry. But I will say also that it has been a fantastic opportunity to just be able to work in games in general. I assume that you're the same way, but I mean, I grew up playing games pretty much my whole life with the original Nintendo and Super Mario Brothers. And once I realized that, you know, hey, I have an opportunity to work in the game industry and just work on games, that was unbelievable and incredible and unexpected. And China is the kind of place where, you know, you can really get your foot in the door in that way. And I think if I'd been in the United States and, you know, a mobile app developer had met me and I had said, yeah, well, I've never done user interface design before, they'd be like, all right, well, nice to meet you. Like, take care. And that would lead to nothing because that's a really developed, you know, economy of workers. And China doesn't have that. So it is a real opportunity.
Yeah, it's a great place to build your resume if you've never had any experience before. And also, I'd like to say a lot of my coworkers were really great people. Yeah. Maybe the industry is not great, and they are just kind of
victims of the system that they're in, but a lot of them are very talented, hardworking people in China.
Yeah. It's also a great way to experience China. I mean, it's a very exciting industry to be a part of. It's always changing, and it's just been a really cool thing to participate in. You know, I'm just the gaming industry in general, especially going to GDC and interacting with, you know, global gaming community characters. It's been really rewarding and exciting. And I mean, I think we come to China in general for the opportunity to do something, you know, memorable and interesting. And being able to work in the Chinese gaming industry is certainly that.
It's been a ride.
Yeah, it's been a real ride. Also, I'd love to mention also that this has led you to become an independent game developer, right? You're on the verge of releasing your first game.
That's right. I kind of took my experience that I had and I went to make my own game. Very small team. I'm making it in GameMaker. My girlfriend does the art. A local musician is doing the music and sound. And I'm releasing Carrier Commander, which is a mobile naval strategy game. Hopefully this year, I'm going to start testing in September. And hopefully by the end of this calendar year, I'm going to release Carrier Commander. It's going to be on Android and iOS.
That is fantastic. I also want to say that, you know, when I was in the trenches a few years ago working on some of the projects which I've described in this podcast, I really felt like I wanted to do something positive and give back and contribute in some way. I felt a responsibility to do that. And the, you know, creating the CGF, the Chengdu Gaming Federation, was a big part of that, you know, creating a community which was, you know, celebrating the good principles of the game industry. And so that's been a rewarding way to kind of give back. And maybe you had a similar thing where you're working on games which you don't like in the day, and then you have in mind a really cool game that you want to make yourself. And so you get the initiative to develop your own game.
Yeah, you know, when I'm done with this game, my next goal is to make a kind of game that we would play at a CGF event, where, you know, we just all meet at the bar and we grab the controllers and we just laugh and play games together. And I think those are the best kind of games.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. For anyone who's listening to this and is interested in checking out previous episodes, you can find those on iTunes or on Stitcher. You can also stream or download them from our website at chengdugaming.com. And thanks very much. We're playing those